I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay, Richard, paper or plastic?
You mean which one is better or worse for the environment?
Yeah.
I guess that paper is better than plastic. Uh-oh.
Actually, the answer is... it's complicated. You know, you'd have to do tons of research to really figure this out. I mean, which one emits more pollution, emits more carbon? Is it going to wind up in a landfill or some whale's stomach? And that's what our show is about today. How so many things we think about the environment, answers that we think are easy, turn out to be wrong, or at least much more complicated than we thought.
Contrarian Environmentalism with Ted Nordhaus.
We are swimming with the long-term big drivers and trends of modernization. So environmentalism, in a lot of cases, wants to swim against those trends.
Our show is about fixes.
Yeah, how to make the world a better place.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
Our listeners always tell us that they like it when we present things they haven't heard before.
So we're going to test that proposition today. So get ready to be pushed well outside your comfort zone.
Right, no safe spaces on this show. Our guest is Ted Nordhaus. He's the founder of the Breakthrough Institute, an environmental think tank.
Ted is also one of the key thinkers and advocates behind a movement called eco-modernism.
Ted Nordhaus joins us via Skype from Oakland, California. Welcome to How Do We Fix It?
Thanks for having me.
Well, we want to get into the ideas behind the eco-modernist movement. But first, can you give us a specific example of one of the stances you take that sometimes is a little controversial in some quarters? For example, explain to us why big commercial farming is usually better for the environment than those small organic farms we all love.
You know, the reason that we support industrial agriculture is just the evidence in terms of just the environmental impacts associated with every unit of corn or soybeans or chicken or anything else you produce. It's just much more environmentally efficient.
So you're saying that modern farming uses less land, right?
It uses less land per unit of output. It often uses significantly less fertilizer and nitrogen, uses less water. By most of the metrics that matter, it's got lower greenhouse gas emissions per calorie of output.
So you're not saying let's just spray all the pesticides and fertilizers we can, though. I mean, you're advocating
In fact, you know, again, the trends with in American agriculture are moving in the other direction, not because of organic agriculture, but just because the pesticides are getting better and less toxic. It's less important how much volume of pesticide you spray is how toxic the pesticide is at the volumes that you're using it. So, you know, one of the really controversial pesticides right now, it shouldn't be, but it is glyphosate, which is branded as Roundup. We use a lot of it, but it's very low toxicity, and it's replaced much, much nastier stuff. Glyphosate is actually a success story. It's replaced organophosphate and other much more nasty herbicides.
The whole debate over big agriculture versus organic, pesticides versus no pesticides, is often governed by slogans. One thing's bad, the other thing is good. Tell us about precision agriculture and what that is.
Yeah, so precision agriculture is the use of technology to both much more carefully sort of monitor the growth and needs of crops during the course of their growth, and then to deliver the things that they need much more precisely, whether it's satellite imagery or even like tiny little sensors in fields, GPS guidance, things like that. We're able to do a whole bunch of things that, you know, increase output, increase yields, and reduce the need for various sorts of inputs, land, water, fertilizer, pesticides. So, you know, these include like being able to kind of tell exactly sort of how much water stress or heat stress a crop at any given moment is having, or knowing exactly when it needs nitrogen and fertilizer, and then being able to deliver those things really precisely. So a lot of big farms, for instance, now have moved to what's called fertigation, which are very, very efficient drip irrigation systems in which the fertilizer is dissolved in the water. It's sort of delivered very, very precisely to the crops.
So that's a great example of the kind of science-based, data-centric, technology-focused position that the Breakthrough Institute takes a lot. Let's back up now a little bit and look at the more philosophical side of this movement. What is eco-modernism?
Well, if you look at sort of modern environmentalism kind of conceptually and philosophically, there have been really two big ideas. One is that we need to shrink the human footprint so that we have less impact on the environment. We need less of nature for human well-being, and we can leave more of nature for the sort of rest of creation to thrive. The second big idea is that we need to harmonize human societies with nature, that human societies have sort of fallen from nature, gotten out of sync with nature, that over the long term will be punished for that, and that will create catastrophe and collapse. And what we say in the manifesto is that, you know, in a world with 7 going on 9 or 10 billion people, most of whom want to live something that looks like a modern life, you can do one of those things, but you can't do both. You can shrink the footprint, which actually means becoming sort of less dependent on nature.
Critics will say, what about localism? What about small scale? What you appear to be advocating, at least to some ears, is an industrialization of farming, all of us living in big cities, going out perhaps on our days off to have a look at the unfettered countryside. But we don't live like that, especially in the United States.
Richard, you live exactly like that.
Well, I do. I do, but a lot of people in America live in exurbs. They live in villages. They live in farming areas.
Those small farms are hobby farms. They produce a vanishingly small amount of our actual food.
With respect, I think the term hobby farms is a little dismissive.
All right. I'm they're not all hobby farms, but they're also kind of this is not the reality of American agriculture today. And 2% of the American population works in agriculture. That's down from 50% 100 years ago and 90% 200 years ago. So this is the world we live in today. Globally, it's an urban planet already, and it's going to get more urban. And it's getting more urban not for environmental reasons. It's getting more urban because, you know, what agriculture has actually meant for human societies throughout, you know, most of human existence has been just deep agrarian poverty. It's meant women and children not getting educations, working in the fields, doing hard agrarian labor. And the reality is that most people given an option to do almost anything else decide to do something else.
Ted, let's talk a little bit about what you're up against in terms of ideology. Many environmentalists believe that we need to reverse a lot of trends in our civilization. We need to use less energy, stop focusing on economic growth, go back to a simpler way of life, you know, or as Joni Mitchell saying, go back to the garden. And you're arguing essentially the opposite. Why?
Well, you know, first of all, we're not going to do that. And even those environmental folks making those cases aren't going to do that. These are people who live among the most high consumptive, privileged lives that humans have ever lived. I mean, it's not accidental that sort of environmental consciousness and ideology, sort of comes into being in the years after World War II, where these developed Western economies have kind of, for the first time like ever, you know, they sort of mass societies have escaped scarcity. And it's at this moment that a bunch of people in those societies decide that it's all been a sort of terrible mistake. But the reality is that none of those people are actually going to go back to living that way.
It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And our guest is Ted Nordhaus of the Breakthrough Institute, an environmental think tank and also an eco-modernist. And on this show, we're kind of explaining what that is, and we'll have more coming up.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Before we continue with Ted, it's our new feature, our recommendations of things to watch, listen to, or read. Jim, you're chomping at the bit. I know you've got something to share with us.
Well, this is not a new idea, and it's probably already on the reading list of a lot of How Do We Fix It listeners, but I want to put in a plug for The Economist. And Richard, you are actually the one who got me a subscription to this magazine.
I did?
A couple of years ago, yeah. And you know, I don't read that much in print anymore. I read The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Times on
weekends.
That's
quite a lot, Jim.
But no, compared yeah. to, yeah. as a lifelong magazine and journalism lover. Yeah. But The Economist does really, really solid work. And I find myself all of a sudden caring about the election in Ghana or, you know, getting a better understanding of what's going on with China and the oppression of the Uyghurs. A lot of issues that our mainstream press in the U.S. don't do a great job covering.
Well, when I was a daily news guy, when I worked at ABC News and I did newscasts every day, when I took a 2-week vacation, I'd come back and I'd always be amazed that we're still talking about exactly the same thing and that there isn't really that much difference between one day and the next. And what is good about The Economist is I think they take a step back. So getting back to our interview with Ted, eco-modernism might seem like it's just hard-headed technocratic thinking, but it has a spiritual side, which really interests me. In your manifesto, you say, modernization theology should be grounded in a sense of profound gratitude to creation, human and non-human. It should celebrate, not desecrate, the technologies that led our pre-human ancestors to evolve. So do you see the potential to win over more religious and conservative people who believe that we are stewards of God's earth?
Yeah, and you know, we've had a bunch of conversations with a whole set of folks who actually see eco-modernism a different story about humans and nature and the environment that actually kind of fits better with their sort of religious and spiritual orientation. So at the core of this, we are arguing that humans haven't fallen from nature, we've risen, and that our technologies don't alienate us from the world and from our own humanity, but they actually create our humanity. That's what made us human, was our tools, our technologies. Early tool use, early use of sort of fire and the ability to cook and ferment foods and things like that actually allows us to digest and consume much more protein, which allowed us to evolve and develop bigger brains. So this idea that sort of technology robs our humanity and something essential about humans, it's just wrong.
Your organization is called the Breakthrough Institute. Talk about the need for technology and invention to play a role in reducing the impact of climate change.
Yeah. So, you know, at Breakthrough, we really focus on technological solutions to environmental problems. And that's not just because we're kind of, we love technology or we're near Silicon Valley or anything like that. That's because technology is the thing that mediates the relationship between human well-being and environmental impacts. Like the move from hunting and gathering to agriculture, that's technology mediating this relationship between humans and environmental impacts. And
so let's bring it up to today. In the economic sphere, there's a widespread view that the more we consume, the bigger our economies get, the worse the impact will be on the environment. There'll be more carbon emissions, more waste, more everything. But you point to a long-standing trend that you want to accelerate, which you call decoupling. Explain how that works.
Decoupling is really decoupling environmental impacts from economic activity. And that's been going on for a very long time. That as our technologies become more efficient, one of my favorite kind of little trends, you know, you think of the what we used to call a tin can, and now it's an aluminum can. And if you look at the amount of material, even in an aluminum can, after it switches over from tin in the 50s, from like the late 50s, you need to.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You're hearing our studio watchdog in the background there. Give us a sec.
Apologies for the interruption.
Ted, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah. You know, a great example of this is, you know, what we used to call a tin can, because they were made from tin. And then in the 50s, we substituted and started making those cans with aluminum. And even since we switched over from tin to aluminum, the amount of aluminum in a tin can has fallen like 90% for the same size can, doing exactly the same function.
So what you're saying is that over time, our economy can grow and our environmental impact will actually decrease significantly.
Yeah. As societies become more developed and more affluent, fertility rates decline. So the population growth, which actually has been the biggest driver of rising environmental impacts over the last century or so, fertility rates are falling rapidly all over the world. Economies are still growing around the world, but as economies get richer, they start growing a lot slower. So, you know, in the US, Europe, Japan, now we sort of struggle to maintain like 2% annual growth rates.
To what extent does environmentalism depend on democracy, on the relationship between individuals and their government? Where do we as individuals fit into this picture?
Yeah, I mean, I the solutions I'm talking about aren't really so much global. I mean, a global transition to clean energy will ultimately impact things like climate change at a global scale. But I'm actually not of the view that the sort of world is going to sit down at a UN conference and decide to rapidly ratchet down carbon emissions. I mean, we've been trying to do that for three decades.
So do we have to invent our way out? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that sort of technological innovation is the key. And that once you have cheap, clean energy technologies, the sort of political and economic lift necessary to sort of really deeply cut emissions gets much easier. And you don't even necessarily need an international agreement to do it.
So, Ted, you're a bit of a skeptic on the idea that renewable energy is going to solve the problem all by itself, wind and solar, and that'll do it, because of the massive amount of land they require and also because of the lack of reliability. So one of the kind of benchmark positions of the Breakthrough Institute is the importance of nuclear power. And you're seeing some progress in a lot of these small nuclear startups. Are you optimistic that we're going to get past this old-fashioned model of just a few giant nuclear plants and we're going to start seeing little small, you know, modular reactors popping up all over the place, including, say, you know, as you mentioned, factories where they need a lot of heat to do processes as well as electricity?
Well, I think nuclear is going to have to kind of get past these big, massive public works projects if it's going to have significant future. And, you know, there are promising developments. There are a bunch of these startups, and they're not just sort of ideas on paper. I think the big question is just going to be, can they get to a point where they're really cheap?
Ted, in the Eco-Modernist Manifesto, it says, "We write this document out of deep love and emotional connection to the natural world." Are you hopeful that that love for the natural world is going to see us through, that we'll find success?
I am. We are swimming with the long-term big drivers and trends of modernization. So environmentalism, in a lot of cases, wants to swim against those trends, against the intensification and scaling up of agriculture, against the sort of shift of large populations from agrarian to urban living arrangements. And that will fail. It has failed. It will continue to fail. And on the other hand, I look at a bunch of these trends and kind of go, you know, look, we're not going to go back to a pre-industrial world or to the North America as it looked before we cleared the forest and hunted all the mammoths into extinction. But I think we can get to a world where we may not stabilize at 2 degrees, but I think we'll stabilize at, you know, 3. And we get to a future where we actually have a big rainforest still in the Amazon, and we leave a lot of biodiversity and a lot of habitat that just exists for its own sake and not to meet human needs. That's a future that I think is entirely plausible. I think it's possible. And I think the key to it is actually accelerating a set of these processes in terms of agricultural modernization and urbanization, especially.
Great.
Okay, great.
Thanks so much. This is great.
Thanks,
Alrighty.
Guys.
Jim, I want to start with an element of discord, because I think that Ted was a little too dismissive of romantic environmentalists. I think that every movement, if it's to change society, needs its element of romance and even occasionally nostalgia. I feel that we need to include individuals, include local groups in our environmental movement, if we're going to improve our relationship with our planet. And so I accept a lot of what he's saying, but I think the tone is a little bit forbidding, especially for those of us who need persuading.
Right. Well, it may be a tone thing, but at the same time, I mean, I spent a lot of time in this world, and there is a wing of environmentalism that is very rooted in this kind of nostalgia, this idea that humans are the problem. I think that some of the warm, fuzzy ideas, I mean, I like going to the farmer's market, getting my organic produce, but that's not going to save the world. And so, yeah, it's important. Let's not just stress what they're against. Let's stress what they're for. They're for a healthier, greener planet. So you can say, oh, everybody living in cities sounds so modern, but we can't all live on our own individual mountaintops. There's not enough mountaintops. You know, we can't encourage everybody to spread out. Let's live like you do, Richard, in relatively dense areas, and then put aside more land for real nature.
It's How Do We Fix It? With a question mark at the end. I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Tim Meigs.
And thanks for joining us. Our producer is Miranda Schaefer, and we are a production of Davies Content. Davies Content makes, we really cut things out, reduce things. In fact, I think we're ruthless editors.
Is that why I never hear my own voice in the podcast once you're done with it?
Exactly, exactly. Find out more at daviescontent.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.